have you told me about it?
All right, we called together the start of our Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary, and we're opening our first meeting of the interim for today, September 30th. And let my colleague go ahead and do his.
Open the House Judiciary Interim Committee.
And I want to thank everyone for being here today. What we're going to try to do, as you probably understand, under the framework that we're working between the two chambers, we're consolidating all of our meeting dates within a 2 to 3 day period every 8 to 10 weeks, whatever that's going to turn out to be. And with that in mind, we have much shorter time to actually ponder the issues that might be before judiciary on either side. Because I know for myself, I will be sitting in Environment and Natural Resources Committee with my good chair, Senator Dingfelder, this afternoon. So we are going to be tighter on time, and for I know a lot of people would like to maybe give their perspectives of, and what we're doing today for many of the issues that we're trying to, let's say, address, is open up the discussions and have work groups that will be working through this interim period.
Okay, and just the one thing I'd like, additionally, I'd like to say, Representative Chip Shields, who's been a member of the House Judiciary Committee, has been appointed to the Senate. He's going to be sworn in today, and he's not here at the committee today, and he has been replaced on the House Judiciary Committee by Representative Tomei. Welcome aboard.
Yay.
And regarding my members, Senator Wissett is in transit. He will be here shortly, and Senator Boquist has military duty, and he will not be able to attend today. So I think our first point of order or business we need to take care of is the an introduction of the committee members, which we've done, the staff. I'm going to ask Bill if you would be so kind to start off.
The far end of the horseshoe here, I don't know whether she's to my right, is Anna Braun, who was counsel last session and sessions before with the Business Committee, and our office manager at the keyboard back there is Enola DeJong. She was our office manager during session, and I'm Bill Taylor. I'm one of the co-counsel to both House and Senate Judiciary Committee, as is Anna. And we're looking forward to an interesting session leading up to February.
All right, thank you. Now, one of the things for all the members, we have these nice spiffy notebooks. I know many committees are going to be very jealous to understand that we actually have class in our committees. I've also been told that you can leave your notebook at the end of the day, and staff will pick them up and will supplement them as necessary. So when we meet again, they'll have the most recent additions to your notebooks. And any other, besides the adoption of the rules, what else do we need to cover in the introduction part? All right, with that, then the Senate will first take in a motion for the adoption of the committee rules.
So moved.
Senator Dingfelder moves for the adoption of the committee rules. And Bill, can you just go over very briefly as to the framework of the type of rules that we're using and to them being pre-approved and all that good stuff by the
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, both rules are for the House and Senate are exact duplicates of the rules before every other committee of the respective chamber. The main thing is, especially for the interim, that all actions must be taken by a majority vote of the committee, not of the quorum. So it's a majority vote of the committee. And that's basically it. The chair sets the agendas for both committees.
Okay.
And as I said before, it's a majority vote of the committee, not the quorum.
All right, and I think the other thing we need to maybe put on the record is that we, the Senate committee, are acting separate and distinct from the House committee. It was determined by our leadership that they wanted us to meet together but not to be a joint committee, so we are two separate committees for the purposes of this during the interim. And with that, is there any discussion as to the rules that are proposed for the Senate committee? Not hearing any objections? So ordered.
In the House, I take a motion to adopt the rules.
So moved.
Representative Stigler moves the adoption of the rules. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
All right. So I think we're through most of the formalities. I guess there's one thing that, if this is, would be the appropriate time, there was a request by one of the members to kind of put on the record as to what each of the committees are going to be able to do in the way of introduction of bills, as well as members. So my understanding at this point, the Senate Judiciary Committee is currently, and I say currently, limited to two bills to be introduced. I am in negotiations with the President's office to give us more flexibility because of the number of items that we usually have in front of us as compared to some of the other committees.
Yeah.
We'll see whether or not we get any leniency on that. And it's also my understanding that each member will be able to have two personal bills introduced.
And on the House side, we'll have one personal bill and then two committee bills.
All right.
So, Council Taylor has
bill. As a committee, Representative Barker, particularly in the House side, if we have a bill, it appears that we need to do something today concerning that, at least expressing an intent or desire to move forth in that bill. And we have to have something to the Speaker's office concerning that by October 5th. And our next meeting is not until November, so.
Okay. All right. And so before the end of the day, that will need to be covered on the House side. All right, and the other thing I believe that has been handed out to everyone is the work plans for both the House and the Senate Judiciary Committees. And I guess take note of that as to what we have laid out as a framework. It is subject to change depending on the urgency of other issues. And we will try to give notice to all members prior to walking in if there are going to be any additions or deletions from what the work plan has. And with that, and Bill, unless there's something else, I'm going to go ahead and move into the informational meeting stage.
Chair, members of the committee, I do notice that, as you probably know, there's been a change in the House agenda for this meeting, and that should be reflected over into the work plan, because the change in the House agenda was just made the other day, so that should be reflected. I'm talking about the issue of campus safety.
All right, so it's my understanding that at this point, it's been determined that the Senate will be moving forward as to having the discussion and the interim work group regarding campus safety. I will encourage any of the House members who have an interest in that area to participate voluntarily, as long as you're not going to run amok with leadership, but we'd love to have you participate with us through that process. And we will be dealing with that issue at the end of today's meeting to allow those members who choose not to be part of it from the House to be able to take on other tasks. With that, let's go ahead and move into, I'm assuming we're going to start off with then the overview of the crime and mental health issues. And Bill, if you can get us going as to the framework of what we have, or is this Anna's? I'm not sure who has the lead on this one.
Chair, members of the committee, you have two bills and then one concept in front of you. The two bills came from last session, House Bill 3342. On what we have is Richard Harris here and Mary Claire Buckley to give us an overview of the mental health system. There's another person whose name escapes me, but I'm sure they'll remind me. As to how people get into the state hospital, either by civil commitment, guilty but for insanity, or unable to aid and assist. And this overview will give us a better idea of what their system is. The two bills we have before us are House Bill 3342, a bill that came in from the Oregon District Attorneys Association last session. And that would change how we treat guilty but for insanity. As you'll hear soon, when you're found guilty but for insanity, you go to the jurisdiction, the PSRB, and go to the state hospital until you are cured or you're able to live in the community under community treatment. And your sentence is based on the classification of A, B, or C felony. This would say that when you are cured, you would go to the state penitentiary. That was the bill. Senate Bill 846 comes in from, Judge Hargraves authored this bill, and this basically would recalculate the sentences under guilty but for insanity to be based not on the classification of A, B, or C felony, but based on the actual sentence you would have received, say, for example, under Measure 11 or under sentencing guidelines. The final bill comes in from Paul Frazier, the district attorney of Coos County, and relates to an issue that's come up, and that is that if you're unable to aid and assist, you go to the state hospital until you are able to aid and assist, or I believe a period of 3 years, and then the state can commence civil commitment proceedings if you are still unable, if you're a danger to self or others. And he has some issues on that concerning someone who never ever who committed a murder, but is an IQ below 40 and has other mental health issues. And this person will never be able to aid and assist, or will always be a danger to self or others. And then you, as you go through the civil commitment proceedings, you have a hearing either every 6 months or every year, depending on what your, whether it's your developmentally disabled or mentally ill. And they're saying that maybe under these circumstances it should be easier to facilitate moving into the civil commitment proceeding, and that maybe you shouldn't have to have that hearing as often as you currently do. That's a rough overview of the bills and the concepts.
Right. And how are we going to have the overview presented to us? Invite those who are going to be participating in that. Please come forward.
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Prior to assuming that position, I was a public defender in Multnomah County, and based on that experience, Mr. Taylor has asked me to provide you with an overview of the legal system as it currently is for persons who enter the criminal justice system with a, who have a mental disease or defect and may ultimately end up at the state hospital. I had have provided you, I think it's being passed out at this point, two PowerPoint presentations, one on the process, current statutory framework for fitness to proceed, also known as aid and assist or competency or capacity. Those terms are often used interchangeably. And one on the guilty except for insanity process. However, due to the constraints of time, I'm not going to walk you through those presentations, but may refer to them. Rather, I am going to focus my comments on the diagram, two-sided diagram that you have before you that's color-coded with regard to the parties of responsibility. When an individual with a mental disease or defect is charged with a crime and enters the legal system through the court doors, there are systems available to those individuals that are not necessarily available to other persons charged with a crime. And fundamental to our legal system is that anybody charged with a crime must be competent to face those charges. And so when an individual first is you know, brought in, and an attorney has to consider whether, in fact, this individual understands the nature of the proceedings, can cooperate with counsel, or participate in their own defense. So that's the first step in determining whether this individual can be prosecuted. If the attorney in their discussions, or frankly a court or any party in the system, can raise the issue of fitness to proceed. But if that question is raised, then a defense attorney would seek a psychiatric or psychological evaluation for that purpose. And that can be done either by a private practitioner, a psychologist or psychiatrist in the community, or can be done at Oregon State Hospital. If in fact that evaluator finds that the individual is fit to proceed, that ends that inquiry and the person proceeds through the criminal justice system. If, however, the individual is found not to be able to aid and assist, then that triggers another process, which is that they would appear before the court. The court would make that finding, and then the judge, in most cases, ends up committing the individual to the state hospital for care and treatment until they regain capacity to proceed to trial. The statute does provide the court with the option of releasing a defendant on supervision in the community for treatment until fit. However, that option is not, at least historically, has not been utilized very often, although there are now efforts underway in some communities to use that option more often. If somebody is found unable to aid and assist, not fit at the time, then and this sent to the hospital, then it's the hospital's responsibility to do an evaluation to determine if the person has regained capacity. Are they at this time presently able to proceed, or will they never be able to proceed? Is it likely that they'll never be able to proceed? Or finally, are they not fit now, but with treatment, it's likely that in the substantially likely in the future that they will be able to proceed? And those are the three types of findings that could be made. If the person has regained capacity, they're sent back to court and proceed through the criminal prosecution. If they are are deemed not likely to ever regain capacity, they too are sent back to the court immediately, and at that point, under the box of never fit, the court would have to, under the current statute, dismiss the case without prejudice, and then make a determination whether the individual should be discharged or whether, in fact, the court should initiate civil commitment proceedings. And if you flip to the back side of that document, you'll see that the process, when the court finds that they are never, it's likely that they will never be able to proceed, then they could order a civil commitment investigation. Then it would be referred to the county mental health program to investigate whether a hearing should be held. If they determine one should be held, then they would go to court, and the hearing would determine whether they meet civil commitment criteria or not. If they do not meet criteria, the court must release the individual. If they are found to be a danger to self, others, or unable to care for their basic needs, then once again they could be committed to the custody of the Department of Human Services and either committed to the state hospital or committed on an outpatient basis. The commitment in the civil commitment, when it's an individual involved with a mental illness, is for 6 months, and for persons with developmental disabilities, that commitment is for 1 year. And that is, as Mr. Taylor indicated, is the concern that District Attorney Frazier has, and we'll be talking to you about in a bit. If, however, back on the front side, if the individual has been found by the hospital unable to aid and assist at the moment, but there is likelihood that they can regain that capacity, then they would remain in the state hospital for care and treatment until such time as they have regained that ability. Once the hospital determines that they are fit, they once again are sent back to the court and the criminal proceedings recommence. So that's the aid and assist process in a nutshell. The other way that individuals in the criminal justice system can end up at the state hospital is if they assert the insanity defense successfully in Oregon. And that involves a process whereby once you determine that your client, is fit to proceed, in reviewing the case, talking to your client, investigating, if it appears that the defendant's mental health status is implicated in the commission of the crime, then it would be incumbent upon the defense attorney to explore whether, in fact, the insanity defense is available to the individual for this particular charge. To be found guilty except for insanity in Oregon, a psychiatrist or psychologist would have to make the finding that as a result of that mental disease or defect at the time of the crime, the individual lacked substantial capacity to either understand the or appreciate the criminality of their conduct, or to conform their conduct to the requirements of law. That means either that they didn't know what they were doing was wrong, or even if they knew it was wrong, they couldn't, you know, control themselves or do differently. That evaluation can either, once again, be done by a private practitioner in the community, or can be done by the staff at the Oregon State Hospital. But in any event, I want to assure the committee that an evaluation, the statute requires that an evaluation for this purpose be done by a psychiatrist or a psychologist. If, in fact, the evaluator opines that the person does qualify for the defense, then a determination by the client in consultation with their attorney will take place to determine whether, in fact, they are going to assert the defense. Because in Oregon, the insanity defense is an affirmative one. It's a decision that the defendant makes. It cannot be imposed by a judge or a district attorney. If the individual decides to assert it, then there are processes that have to be followed, including giving notice to the state. The state has the right to get their own evaluation if they so chose, and that often is done at the state hospital. And ultimately, they go back to court and determine either through trial or most often by stipulation. And by stipulation, once again, I mean that the district attorney and the defense attorney agree that this is the appropriate disposition. They're not making the decision that the person qualifies for the defense. That has to be done by a psychologist or psychologist, as I mentioned. But they are agreeing that based on that report or reports of those professionals, that in fact this is the way to go. And if they agree, then they would go before a judge. They would have what we call a stipulated facts trial, meaning that they agree to the end finding, and the court would make a finding of guilty except for insanity. That would be the verdict, so to speak. If the crime is a felony or a misdemeanor involving injury or risk of physical injury, then that individual is placed under the Psychiatric Security Review Board. They are placed under the board for the maximum sentence provided by statute for the crime. So for a murder, they're placed under the board for life. For an A felony, it's 20 years, B is 10, C is 5, and similarly for misdemeanors, a year, 6 months, or 30 days. Frankly, is one of the concerns that the district attorneys have and will be addressed, I believe, by Mr. Neely shortly. The length of jurisdiction, I will also tell you, is the length of time that the board has legal authority over the board. It does not refer in any way at this point to the length of hospitalization, no length of time that they have to be in a secure environment. That is not implicated by the length of jurisdiction. That is, under the current statute, is to be determined by the board based on their progress in treatment and their risk assessment. Point to the length of jurisdiction is that, as Mr. Taylor mentioned, sentencing guidelines do not apply at this time, and that's what Judge Hargraves is going to speak to with regards to Senate Bill 846. So they're placed under the board, then the last decision the court has to make is whether they are committed to the state hospital directly from the courtroom, or whether, in fact, they can be adequately controlled and treated in the community under what's called a court conditional release. I will tell you at this point about only 15% of the individuals are court conditionally released. That used to be a larger percentage in years past, but in the last couple of years, that's gone down to about 15% of the individuals. The rest are sent directly to the state hospital for care and treatment. And at this point, I'm going to ask Superintendent Orr to tell you a little bit about what happens when they get to the hospital.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the Joint Committee. I'm the mystery person introduced earlier. My name's Roy Orr, for the record, and I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, and have been for the last year and a half or thereabouts. It's a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk to this group about some of the things that are going on at the state hospital, and I realize we're but a part of what you're here to consider today, so I'll make my comments brief. We, in fact, provide the evaluations and the treatment for patients who are remanded to our custody until the PSRB deems them fit to be able to be conditionally released to the community. And I'll have Mr. Harris, the Assistant Director of AMH, speak to the community side of treatment in a few moments. When patients are remanded to us, we provide an intensive initial evaluation. Those evaluations are updated on a periodic basis. We have a history of having struggled as an organization with providing timely and an intensity of treatment that's befitting the expensive environment that our residents do in fact reside in. And I'm pleased, to be able to mention to all of you that our replacement hospital is well underway now, and I'd like to extend an invitation to any of you who have not been out recently or maybe have not had an opportunity to visit the state hospital campus before. We'll actually be moving into the very first phase of the new hospital in late 2010, so in approximately 1 year from now. We are now fully staffed with regard to psychiatrists. All of our positions are filled. It's an enviable position for any hospital to be in the country, let alone in a subspecialty like psychiatric care. We have a 1% psychiatric nurse vacancy rate right now, which again is an enviable position to be in. We're grateful to be in such a position. We have improved the treatment care planning process, formalized it, and we are making it more universal across both of our campuses, the larger one, of course, here in Salem, and a smaller campus in Portland. By virtue of being fully staffed now with regard to physicians and nurses, key positions, and we do continue to recruit for other positions, the nucleus of our treatment teams are much stronger. But one of the most dramatic changes in psychiatric care in recent years has been the advent of the psychiatric medications that we're now able to use. All of these things allow us the opportunity to bring forward a number of significant improvements from staff to how we treat and the environment within which we treat in preparation for periodic PSRB hearings and the ultimate disposition to folks who are deemed by the PSRB to be conditionally released to the community. I'll stop at that point and introduce Mr. Harris.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Richard Harris. I'm the Assistant Director for Addictions and Mental Health within DHS. It's the responsibility of Addictions and Mental Health to provide an array of services in the community to people in need of addiction and mental health services. That includes a significant investment in residential facilities of different types all around the state to provide residential support for people, but in addition it also includes prevention activities, crisis management, outpatient services, and supported employment and education, and a variety of different kinds of services to help people deal with their addiction and mental health problems. Primarily, the system in Oregon operates in partnership with each county. We generally have contracts with all the counties, and in turn, they provide the services either by the counties themselves or through subcontracts with others. And in the residential system of care, those services are generally provided by nonprofit organizations in each community in contracts with the counties. So this handout that with the map of Oregon on it really is just a snapshot of the available residential facilities in throughout the state in which PSRB supervised individuals may be living. So they're still under jurisdiction of the PSRB, but AMH and the counties and the nonprofit providers are providing these residential facilities out in the community. So there's a four levels of care, basically adult foster care, residential treatment home, residential treatment facilities and secure residential treatment facilities. The PSRB makes decisions about at what level of care somebody would best receive the services that would help them continue with their mental health, and has the option to refer people to a variety of these facilities around the state. There's approximately 230 to 40 individuals in these facilities that are under jurisdiction of the PSRB at any one time. The capacity in our facilities is much higher than that, but we're also serving people who are coming from the civil side of the system. So facilities frequently have some beds where they're occupied by people under PSRB and other beds that are occupied by people that are either from the state hospital or for the community in need of residential care. So this is just a way to say that at the time that people have benefited from care in the state hospital system, and the PSRB judges that they're fit to live in the community, there's this network of services. There are other things in the community that people participate in that may be in housing with supportive services that are still under jurisdiction of PSRB. So that's the nature of the system after the state hospital.
All right, well, thank you. We've got questions that are coming in. First, I'm going to represent Senator Dingfelder, and then we'll go to the other side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would actually for any of the panelists, but you did answer the first part of my question, was how many supervised patients do we have statewide? So I heard about 230 or 240 for PSRB. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dingfelder, actually there are 367 individuals on conditional release throughout the state. The number that Mr. Harris referred to was those who are in these particular residential facilities, but we also have individuals who are living in supported housing or living independently.
Okay, thank you. And what is the number the state hospital currently?
Approximately... Yeah, I was going to say 370, but 360, 370, thereabouts.
Okay, and one follow-up question.
Yes.
Regarding the certification of these facilities, is that done by the state or the counties?
AMH has the licensure responsibility to license all these facilities. However, since they're under contract with the counties share in partnership with actual monitoring of the facilities, but it's the licensure responsibility of the state.
So one final question is for my county, which is on the back here, if I wanted to get addresses, locations of all the, would I get that from you or from the county?
You could get it from either one of us. I would be glad to provide it if you'd like me to.
Thank you.
Rep. Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question presumably for Ms. Buckley, but anyone is welcome to answer it. Approximately how many times per year does a defendant successfully assert the so-called insanity defense?
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, Representative Barton, we are averaging about, you know, over the past 10 years or so, about 85 a year. We've had years where it's, you know, been 65, and then other years where, you know, we peaked at 126 one year, but I would say an average of about 85.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
You might not have, thank you, Mr. Chair, you might not have the statistic, but if you, perhaps you can just give me a guess of that approximately 85 per year. Could you guess about how many times that is, or what percent of that would be stipulated with the state, or how often on turns is somebody actually assert the insanity defense, and then that is contested and successfully adjudicated in front of, by a fact finder?
Chairs, Representative Barton, I would say 90 to 95% of the cases that come to the board are the result of stipulations. A jury trial is extraordinarily rare in Oregon. Successful jury trial, anyway, and that's all we hear about. And
I've never heard of
court trials are also.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Stigler?
Yeah, I just wanted a clarification. Mr. Irwin, you mentioned 360 to 370 beds at the state hospital. You're not talking about psychiatric security review, but beds under their jurisdiction. Is that what specifically?
Okay. Vice Chair Stigler, chairs, members of the committee, I am talking about patients at the hospital who are under the purview of the PSRB.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So those are the beds that are effectively dedicated to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board?
Correct.
Thank you, chairs. So of the 367 people who are in outside the state hospital and on conditional release, how many a year commit a crime again and are referred back to either the state hospital or the criminal justice system?
Chairs, Representative Tomei, our current recidivism rate for the last 10 years, 12 years, is 2.3%. I always hate to do this, so I'll knock on wood and say that there are years when we have no incidents, so that's the total over the last 10, 12 years. Now that's for people who reoffend. I mean, if you were requesting our recidivism rate, people are returned to the state hospital on a revocation for other reasons than criminal activity. However, that could be for the decompensation of their mental illness or a violation, of another condition of release. And we average about four of those per month out of the 367. So that averages out to be about 99.1% of the clients on conditional release each month remain in the community each month.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairs.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And Bill, who else do we have to call up?
Chair, members of the committee, this is basically the overview. We do have the bills before us, and we have other people to speak to the bills. Kevin Neely was here, will be here to talk about 3342. What happened, as you know, we on Monday afternoon changed the agenda to move one issue to the bottom of the agenda. It did not get printed in CAS because CAS was down on Monday until yesterday. So Kevin was planning to be here at 9 and is running a bit because he was going off the old schedule. Bob Jundis is here. Bob represents Disability Rights of Oregon, and every state is required to have a nonprofit organization that advocates for disabled people, and Bob is the head of that organization. I believe he'd like to address 3342.
All right, let's do this. That's fine. Who else do we have on the schedule that provided testimony for 3342 besides Kevin?
No one else that I know of.
Okay.
And then we have Paul Frazier here on the aid and assist issue, and we have Judge Hargraves here on Senate Bill 846, and they're both here.
Okay. So, Bob, why don't you go ahead and get started. If Kevin gets in, we'll do that. If not, we'll move into the others and come back to it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. My name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon, and I have a handout for you that is entitled Crime and Mental Health Issues. And my sole purpose this morning is to just lay out three major points that are, you might think of as constitutional sideboards in this area and why we have some of the systems that you just heard about. And there's three cases that I wanted to just outline for you in these materials when you consider which way to go on some of these bills. And one, the main one is Jackson versus Indiana. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1972, and it lays out some basic premises. And the Jackson case actually involves a situation somewhat like the one that District Attorney Frazier ran into, in that there was a person who was, quote, mentally defective and deaf-mute, who was accused of a crime and was unable to assist in his defense and was, in Indiana, was placed in the state hospital. And the state law there was such that when a person got sent to the hospital because they were unable to aid and assist, they stayed there indefinitely until such time as they could prove that they were able to aid and assist. So For this individual, that meant literally a lifetime in the hospital when he had not been adjudicated as being guilty of a crime. And what the Supreme Court said, and if you look on page 2, the key statement of the court down on the second frame says, due process requires that the nature and duration of commitment bear some reasonable relationship to the purpose for which a person is committed. And in essence, what the court was saying was that when a when the government takes a person's freedom away, that the purpose of doing so and the length of the time that freedom is taken away has to relate to the purpose. When a person is unable to assist their attorney in addressing a criminal charge, the purpose is for them to be returned to capacity so that they can go back to court, they can face their criminal charge and either be take a plea, be convicted, or acquitted. If it appears that the person will never be able to do that, then the reason for holding them goes away because that person cannot be returned to capacity. If the government believes that it needs to keep hold on to that person, then it needs to have another justification for doing so, and that's where civil commitment comes in. So according to the way the court laid it out is that that person would move to a civil commitment proceeding, and again on page 3 at the bottom I have a direct quote from the case. It says, now the government should take a look at the person through its court proceedings and say, is this person beat to have their freedom taken away and be placed in a treatment environment so that because they are dangerous to themselves, dangerous to others, or unable to provide for their basic needs, and if so, the government has a justification for putting them in confinement, providing them with treatment until such time as they're no longer in that status. So our entire aid and assist system in our statutes is primarily framed right around that case. And if you look in the statute, there's some wording that comes right out of Jackson versus Indiana. The second one that I wanted to bring to your attention is Jones versus United States, which is on page 4, 1983 Supreme Court case. And the main provision there is it talks about many things in the case, but one particular holding is that if a person is acquitted or found guilty except for insanity, in other words, they're not convicted of a crime, but they're found to be insane, that person should not then be punished by the government. That person at that point can be held as a result of that finding in a confinement in a treatment environment for the purposes of receiving treatment in custody, but they aren't to be punished. And this goes directly to some of the issues that are raised by House Bill 3342, because in that bill, at least in my reading, if a person successfully used an insanity defense and was placed in the hospital temporarily but was ultimately placed in prison, for that period that the person was in prison, in essence, they would be punished for having committed an act while they were unable to form intent or to understand the nature and quality of their act. So in other words, having been found insane and unable, not responsible for their actions, they would then be punished and once they had received mental health treatment. And so at least in our assessment, a system in which a person ultimately lands in prison, even though found unable to understand the nature and quality of their action and conform their behavior to the law, that would be punishment for an act that, in essence, they didn't do, but their mental illness did for them. And while that does achieve the goal of keeping a person away from society for that period, it would in fact be punishing them for something that they couldn't control, and at least in our reading, would run afoul of Jones versus U.S. The last case that I just wanted to bring your attention has to do with the question of the insanity defense and whether whether a state has to have an insanity defense at all. There are some states around the country, I think five now, that have in fact abolished the insanity defense. And although, actually, I know Alex Bassos is here from the Public Defender, and there's a lot of scholarly work on whether that's appropriate or not appropriate. But there is a case from Nevada that found that abolition of the insanity defense violates both their state constitution and the federal constitution. And again, it comes to the question of whether it is appropriate to hold a person criminally responsible for an act for which they did not, they were not able to understand that what they were doing was wrong. Some state legislatures have decided that that is appropriate. Oregon never has. The vast majority of states never had. I bring this to your attention again because, again, in our reading, what House Bill 3342 would, in many ways, effectively do would be to abolish the insanity defense. And in that, in sending a person to prison who had been found to be guilty except for insanity would have that effect and would then raise additional constitutional questions. The last point I wanted to make was that in advocating for our clients, we advocate for individuals with mental illness throughout the mental health system, and the PSRB and the Forensic Hospital are part of that mental health system. We've worked for years to further the proposition that a psychiatric hospital should in fact be a psychiatric hospital, and that it should be staffed by physicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, people whose job it is to treat a person's mental illness and return them to health. Some of our laws may have the effect of sending people to a psychiatric hospital for the purposes of keeping them away from society, which is really it's a little bit of a different concept than treatment. It's a concept of custody. And I think that one of the questions that we struggle with always is do we want to have a state hospital be, in fact, a type of prison, or do we want it to be a medical facility whose job it is to get people better as quickly and as effectively as possible so that they can return to society as safely as possible without having their mental illnesses flare up and create problems for themselves and others in the future. We think it's very important that our state hospital retain its role, well, and return to its role as being a medical facility and not a jailer. And that is why having a safe and effective environment in the hospital, having adequate staff, having a PSRB that has the tools to evaluate, return people to society in a reasonable amount of time is good for us all and is consistent with some of the constitutional provisions that I've just outlined to you.
Right. So, thank you. Hang on 1 second. Let's see if there's any questions. Bob, thank you very much. And Bill, I see Kevin has not made it in, so...
He was at the door a minute ago. He was at the door, back door.
He was?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I was just talking to Elizabeth Cushwat, and I think it's going to take another 10 minutes. What you may want to do is move on to Senate Bill 846. Yep. Judge Hargraves is here.
No, that's fine. That's what we're going to do, okay. Since we're kind of on this global concept. Judge Hargraves, why don't you come forward?
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, and members of the committee, first of all, let me apologize for sniffing and whatever else I'm going to do while I'm up here. I managed to catch my fall cold just in time for this, so.
Keep it to yourself, please.
Well, yeah, I was hoping none of you would run down and mob me, so if you do, you do it at your peril. I am Jim Hargreaves, and I'm senior circuit judge out of Lane County, and I'm the governor, formerly the governor's special master for the Oregon State Hospital. And Senate Bill 486 arises out of my work as special master, and it's part of my direction from the governor when I undertook that position, was to look at the laws pertaining to how criminal defendants got into, passed through, and got out of the Oregon State Hospital and make recommendations for changes in the law in that process. Now, like most of my colleagues and members of the bar, actually, I found I had only a rudimentary knowledge of this system, even though I've worked as a judge for 20 years. It's really the reason for most of us having not a lot of knowledge is something that Mary Claire Buckley referred to earlier, which is that the vast majority of these cases, both in terms of the fitness to proceed as well as the cases of guilty except for insanity, they all go off by agreement. The DA and the defense lawyer get together and say, yep, and they go to the judge and say, judge, we got this guy here, or we got this woman here, and they all say, fits the statute, let's send them to the hospital. So basically, rarely have lawyers or judges had actually the necessity to spend a lot of time looking at the statutes and looking at the various ways that some of the provisions play together. And I was fortunate enough to have that time and have that directing. And so out of this analysis came some issues that I thought were pretty important. Now, in Senate Bill 846, there are really four main changes problem areas that I thought needed to be addressed. And those four problems are: who should go to the hospital based on lack of fitness to proceed? How long should people stay there on a fitness to proceed commitment? Then who should be placed under the Psychiatric Security Review Board on a guilty except for insanity? And again, how long should someone be kept in the hospital or under the control of the Psychiatric Security Review Board if they are found guilty except for insanity? Now, time isn't going to allow me really to take you through all the analysis that I did to do this. I've given you some background material that I think has been handed out, and some material that will show you the kinds of crimes that people are in the hospital for, both on guilty except for insanity and fitness to proceed, and some other information that'll just, I think, give you a better idea of what we're facing here. So what I'd like to do is take you through these four issues quickly and explain them to you, and then if you have questions in the time remaining, I'd be happy to answer them. So the first issue is: who should go to the hospital on lack of fitness to proceed? And under the current law, the defendant charged with any felony or misdemeanor in a state court, if found to lack fitness to proceed to trial, can be sent to the hospital for treatment. And in fact, they are. Under the provisions of Senate Bill 846, all misdemeanants and all felons whose presumptive sentence for the offense be less than 12 months incarceration would be required to be treated in the community in some appropriate place or manner that will have to be determined. But essentially, the low-lying felonies and misdemeanants would not go to the hospital. Secondly, how long should somebody be kept at the hospital or treatment facility on fitness to proceed? This is one of the real key issues here because, as we'll see in a minute, there's a real legal issue here. Under the law right now, on felons are found not fit to proceed, by default, they go to the hospital for not to exceed 3 years, just because of the way the process is set up here, because the statute says the maximum statutory
sentence or 3 years, whichever is lesser. Obviously, three is always smaller than five, and therefore everybody goes to the hospital for 3 years on a felony. On a misdemeanor, they go for up to the statutory maximum of 1 year, 6 months, or whatever. I've forgotten what the third lowest one is, but anyway, it's based on that. So that would, under 846, that would change, and people would go to the hospital on felonies. Of course, only felonies would be going there. Felons would go for the length of time which would be equal to the sentence they could have received had they pled guilty under the statute. And if you have any familiarity with the sentencing matrix, and I've included that in your material, there's a real disparity between those two numbers. And we'll talk about that in a minute. The third issue, who should go to the hospital on guilty except for insanity? Again, under the current law, Everybody goes who's a felon. If it's a misdemeanor, if there was a possibility of physical harm, those folks go to the hospital under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Under the provisions that have been proposed in 846, only the felons who have a presumptive sentence of 12 months or more of incarceration under the guidelines would go, and all other defendants, including misdemeanors, again, would be taken care of in an appropriate manner in some sort of community-based supervision or facility. The fourth issue, how long should somebody be kept in the hospital under the PSRB? We come back to the same thing. Under the current law, felons who go to the state hospital as guilty except for insanity go for the statutory maximum provided in statute, 5, 10, or 20 years. And if there's two or three charges, the statute currently says the maximum sentence, so that means you stack them if you can, and so you get 5 and 20 and 10 or whatever it is that adds up, and so you can roll the years up a long ways in a hurry depending on how many charges are involved. Again, under the provisions of 846, we go back to the sentencing guidelines and do the same sort of thing, but it would be a sentencing guideline calculation rather than a statutory maximum calculation. And again, those would be two very different numbers in most cases. So why make these changes? Let me address questions 1 and 3 first. Those are the who should go. The reason the proposed limitation set in 846 is really has to do with sort of rationalizing the availability of resources. And when you look down, and I provided you with material here to show you the crimes that people have committed that get them to the state hospital on fitness to proceed, I've also given you some of the hospital records showing you who gets there on guilty except for insanity, you'll see that while there are certainly a lot of people who go to the hospital for very serious personal assaults, murders, rapes, various kinds of person crimes, you'll also find a high number of people who are in there on burglary 2, stealing cars, various theft kinds of cases, lots of property crimes, and low-level felonies. And I think you need to just ask yourself, is that a good use of this very expensive new facility we're building, or can we do something better with the low-level felons and the misdemeanants who come to the hospital, both on fitness to proceed and on guilty except for insanity? So, as I say, I think the who is really a question of resource allocation and rationalizing that. I think the more...
Judge Hargraves?
Yes.
I'm going to need you to start wrapping up. We've allotted an hour for this time. I'm going to go for an hour and 15 minutes, which is 9:30. I've got at least
all right.
Other people.
I can do that very quickly here. The issue around how long should people stay, I believe you have a very serious legal issue on the fitness to proceed, because people are being sent to the hospital for longer than they could go, that they could be kept in jail pending trial or could be sentenced for. And so we have a statute that says you get credit for time served. You end up with people in, being in the hospital longer than they could be in jail. I don't think you can do that. And the other one on the guilty except for insanity, again, goes back to a question of just how long do they need to be there? And I think that's a serious question that needs to be addressed.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you. Thank you for the explanation. It's very helpful. Was there an analysis done, do you know, under Senate Bill 846, if these changes were adopted, how many more facilities in the community we would need? I'm assuming that it would be less costly than the beds in the state hospital, but was there any type of analysis of what that shifting would do in the communities?
Senator Dingfelter, I'm sorry. Not that I know of. I mean, that's something that obviously is going to need to happen. And this is sort of the shot across the bow, and where we go from here, I'm not sure. But it has not been done to my knowledge.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator West.
Actually, two quick ones. You keep referring to some sort of community-based facility. Could you give us some examples of existing community-based facilities where that could... where these people could be treated? And the second question is, shouldn't someone who is incarcerated for criminal insanity remain, or hospitalized for criminal insanity, shouldn't they remain hospitalized or incarcerated until the criminal insanity is mitigated?
Let me take the second question first, and the answer is absolutely, and the law provides for that. And this bill doesn't change that. What it does is say that on the criminal commitment through the criminal court, you'll be under the guidelines. If you max out the guidelines, then what happens today will happen under the bill, which is then you go to the civil commitment proceeding. But it just gets you to that point at a different time. So that remains the same. The civil commitment proceeding is always the backstop if somebody doesn't get better within the time allotted. So that will still happen. Nothing around that will change.
Thank you. I withdraw the first question. Senator Dingfelder pointed out that I missed that. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, Judge, thank you very much. So, Bill, I have, I believe, Kevin Neely as well as Paul Frazier that still need to come forward.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen, why don't you both come up together? We've got about 15 minutes or so to get through your two presentations before we need to move to our next topic.
Dear members of the committee, the Department of Corrections submitted written testimony on one of the bills here, the 3342, but I told them, given the press for time, that they said it's fine. They didn't need to come up and discuss the issue.
All right. If we have time, we'll squeeze something in, but we do have that in written form, and members can make inquiries from them directly. Gentlemen, whoever's going to start.
Co-chairs, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and Chair Brzezinski, I appreciate your indulgence in bringing me up here a little late. I had Enola hand out some written testimony on House Bill 3342. I'm going to address House Bill 3342, and I'll let District Attorney Frazier address aid and assist issues. I will be very brief, I assure you. For those of you that have read House Bill 3342, I think it's safe to say it's a significant departure from the way we have typically handled violent offenders who are found guilty except for insanity. I would tell you at the outset that bill is more expansive than virtually all of the district attorneys in the state would like to see changes be made. So I'll tell you that at the outset. I'm not going to go over the individual characteristics of the bill. They are outlined in my testimony for the sake of time. What I can tell you is a little bit of background about why the district attorneys are interested in this bill and in these issues. It really began when the state hospital, the new hospitals were being built. The district attorneys felt that the involvement of public safety was frankly, not there at all. There was no involvement in the development of the state hospitals with the district attorneys and other law enforcement officials. That caused them a significant amount of concern. We were concerned, in fact, that absent good overview from the public safety needs, we may have some inadequacies in the system itself. As you all know, I'm sure from the testimony you've heard earlier today, the system of the guilty except for insane provisions in the law really require a partnership between our providers in the mental health services area and law enforcement. Absent law enforcement stipulating to these GEI sentences, typically these would end up either in trial or we would end up going through a non-GEI setting. So a couple things that I wanted to highlight, and then I'll turn it over to questions and Paul, are one, what really engaged the district attorneys and the reason that 3342 was introduced last session was because we have seen a significant reduction in length of stay at the state hospital for the most violent offenders. We contacted, you're not our first stop, we contacted the Department of Human Services in 2007 to see if we could get more information as to why there was such a significant 40% reduction in length of stay over a short period of time for the most violent offenders. We did get a letter back from the Department of Human Services. I'll provide that letter to the committee at some point. I did not provide it today, but essentially there was no specific explanation in there. They did allude to the increased use of secure residential facilities. Most district attorneys around the state do support the use of secure residential facilities, I'd add, as we move forward. But again, that significant change in length of stay caused some concerns amongst the district attorneys. Caused concerns for a couple reasons. One of the more principal reasons here is that in moving forward with the stipulation on a guilty except for insanity with offender, the district attorneys are working closely with their communities and closely with the victims. And in their discussions with the victims and in their discussions with the communities, they talk to them about what the typical length of stay is. They talk to them about how the state hospital works. They talk to them about how the psychiatric security review board works. And all of that is important in comforting the victim and comforting the community that, in fact, stipulating to a guilty except for insane finding is the right course of action. And when there's a significant change in how the state hospital is handling those cases, it is difficult for the district attorneys to go back to the victims, to go back to those communities and say, listen, I know we told you that the average length of stay was X amount of days, and now we're seeing that that has been reduced by 40%, without an explanation as to why that's happened. And so I think that's one of the concerns that the district attorneys have moving forward. It may be that that's not an issue that gets addressed legislatively. It may be that what we need to do is work more closely with the state hospital to identify why we're seeing such a reduced length of stay and what the therapeutic reasons are, if there are financial reasons. And then, of course, we can pass that information on to those in the community who are the victims of crime and who are concerned for the safety of their communities. So that's one of the fundamental issues and one of the reasons we brought forward 3342. I'm not going to tell you that it's the right way to go. I think, in fact, it poses some significant problems. I'm sure you heard from some of my colleagues here in the Assembly that there's some constitutional concerns with the bill. There are states that handle, in fact, these cases in similar manner as is proposed in this bill. That being said, what I really wanted to highlight for this committee is the importance of ensuring that that once these offenders move out of the criminal justice system into the state hospital, there continues to be a good line of communication between the practitioners who are working on the mental health side and the prosecutors who are working to reassure the victims in their communities that, in fact, these findings are the right findings, that they're effective outcomes in the criminal justice system, and that they will ensure that our communities are safe. And I would would conclude by saying we recognize that the state hospital probably does have some significant therapeutic enhancements that have occurred over the last decade that it would be good for the district attorneys to learn more about. Two, the PSRB has done an outstanding job of putting public safety first, but we have, in fact, the district attorneys have been appearing in more and more of these cases. Typically in the past, these PSRB hearings, there was no district attorney presence. We are seeing a significant increase in that over the course of the last 2 years. District attorneys are representing themselves, representing the victims in these cases, because they're concerned about the findings that have been made by the state hospital. And again, that's not to say that those findings are without merit, but it's a change from the practices that we've seen over the course of the past decade. Finally, as I said, PSRB is doing a good job. I think that the model of PSRB is outstanding. They obviously are concerned with public safety. Once an offender has moved into a residential setting or moved out of the system and into the community, they are aggressive in monitoring those patients. Monitoring those individuals, and if there is any sort of concerns that they're going to pose some public safety problems, they bring them back in. It works great, and their recidivism rate is virtually zero, which is, I think, something that we'd like to see throughout our public safety system. But in light of the fact that what's worked so well for so long and has resulted in a virtually zero recidivism rate, I think the district attorneys are concerned to see these what they would view as fairly significant changes in length of stay, and are concerned that, in fact, all the successes, the reduced recidivism rates, the virtually no reoffenders, might change because of the changes in practices.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Kevin, I'm somewhat confused. So I'm hearing you say, and certainly in your written testimony you're saying too, that the recidivism rate is almost zero. It's much, much less. The corrections department would be what, perhaps?
30%.
30%, right. This is 2% or less. Sometimes there are no people returning to the state hospital. So I'm a little bit confused. So why, it seems like what you're saying is the DAs are spending more time. So time is the essence for them, but it seems like safety is not the issue here. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
Chair Brzezinski, Representative Tomei, I think that our concern, that the district attorney's concern, is that in fact the significant shifts in length of stay, the significant reductions we've seen in length of stay, will have some downstream concerns, some downstream effects on public safety, and will are unsettling to victims. I do think that it's kind of the theory of why I upset the apple cart. The apple cart's worked really well for a long time in terms of keeping recidivism rate low. And I think one of the concerns the district attorneys have is that that recidivism rate might climb if we see offenders being released into the community at a more accelerated rate.
Follow up, please.
Yes.
So are we seeing an acceleration since they have changed the process? So are you seeing an acceleration rate?
Chair Brzezinski, Representative Tomei, I don't have the answer to that question. I think that is something that will go back. We do have information we received in 2006 from the PSRB, and I think at that point we just started. That was when we first identified the increases or the shortening of length of stay. I do think it's something that we should pay careful attention to. And again, I think, if district attorneys can be assured that, in fact, the recidivism rate is going to remain at that 2% rate, or even, frankly, that is virtually zero, I think that that will give them a significant amount of comfort moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you for the inquiry. And I guess I want to follow up on that. And, Kevin, I guess we now have 2 years to 3 years in works since this acceleration has taken place. I really would encourage your organization to bring forward whatever concerns have been documented, because what we've heard before you were here is that it's 2.3% recidivism, and in some years it's even less than that. That's an average over a 10 to 12 year period. And with that in mind, it seems like, you know, we want to make certain that we have safety as a component here. But at the same time, if we're getting the results that we want,
then I hate to see us basically putting fear out in the communities where it's not warranted. Bill.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Neely mentioned the improvement in psychotropic drugs and the effect that that has. That's also had another effect. Constitutionally, the person in the state hospital and the PSRB has a right to the least restrictive environment. So if they reach the point where the hospital figures that they can be treated in the community, they have a constitutional right to move there. The other thing is it complicates this issue as it relates to community facilities, and Representative Olson was very much involved in this 2 years ago, and that is federal law says that if you have a situation where you allow multi-unit dwellings, you can't prohibit a neighborhood group treatment program in that area by federal law. So that's one of the other complicating factors here. So when you combine those two, least restrictive environment, difficulty in zoning out these particular facilities.
That's correct. All right. Paul, why don't you go ahead and give us your presentation.
Okay, thank you. I'm co-chairs, member of the committee. I'm Paul Frazier. I'm the district attorney in Coos County. The reason I'm here, I have provided some written testimony, and I obviously don't have a lot of time, but I will. The main reason I'm here today is I ran into a situation earlier this year where we had an individual who committed a murder who was severely mentally disabled and is never going to be able to age assist. As Judge Hargreaves pointed out, you can hold someone at the hospital up to 3 years on a felony if they're not able to age assist. There's one part of the statute, though, that, and this is the part that causes the problem that I had, is that if a defendant is found that he will never be able to be fit to proceed, the statute requires that the criminal case be dismissed. And in the case of the case that I had, the individual we were looking at, dismissing a murder charge against him within about 90 days or less. We had to figure out a way, what are we going to do with this individual? Because as we went through and looked at his background and things along that line, we found that he had engaged in a multitude of assaultive behavior over the years, and in fact, the schools had developed a program where they would not allow him to be alone. There had to be two people with him at all times, and the school officials told their teachers, don't turn your back on him because he will attack you if you turn your back on him. There were at least four teachers that were severely, or educational assistants that were hurt by this individual. I was faced with a situation of, okay, I cannot, through the criminal justice system, hold this person under an aid and assist or guilty but insane. The statute said once the judge ruled that he would never be able to aid and assist, and that was frankly obvious from the first day that the case arose, we wouldn't be able to do anything with him. We'd have to put him back out in the community. What I did is we did some research, and we proceeded under the statute that provides for a 1 year commitment as a dangerous mentally retarded individual, and we obtained that 1 year commitment. In the materials I've given you, when this first issue came to mind, I actually came to the Capitol and I spoke with Representative Krieger and Senator Cruz and Representative Roblin about the issue, and Representative Roblin and I and a few other individuals got together and put together a legislative concept, which I've attached there. Unfortunately, because this incident occurred in March and what have you, we didn't have enough time in session to address that situation, but I've attached there LC 3757, which I haven't had a chance to talk to Representative Roblin what his plans are with that for the upcoming session. But the problem I see is every year now for I don't know how long, I'm going to have to make sure that there is some sort of hearing to make sure that this individual, assuming he continues in being dangerous as he is, to have to make sure he's held. And I want to make it clear, my goal in the case was to make sure that this individual had his needs met, that he was being humanely treated. But at the same time, it was clearly obvious that the public needed to have some protection from him. And this may continue for the rest of his life. The legislative concept that I have there with Representative Robel would extend the commitment period of time under the civil statutes out to a 3-year period, so we wouldn't have to do this over and over again every year. This is something that is a concern to DAs, because we are seeing more and more cases now where we are having defendants who have committed really violent crimes who are not able to aid and assist, and who will never be able to aid and assist, and we're faced with the courts dismissing the criminal charges, the person being released back into the community without any supervision, and we're trying to figure out a way, again, to meet their needs, but at the same time, protect the public.
Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Bill?
Chairman, as you could now. If you had the time, I'd say Bob Junif may want to say a few words concerning this issue, but I realize we're...
Well, we already had Bob up once, so...
Yeah, put him back out there. Okay.
Chair?
Gene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Were the counties asked to weigh in? A big part of this is the community programs and community homes, and how this is going to impact the counties. Were they at the table with...
Listen, I assume you mentioned Judge Hargrave's bill, not Paul Frazier's bill. No, they were not asked to weigh into the issue.
Mr. Chair, Chair Walker, I know in my county that mental health does not get funded, the group homes don't get funded. We're just seeing the problem there. We're not really solving the issue, we think. We think the state hospital is doing a great job, the medications they can get out of that system, but they're going to be in the community. I'm concerned about that impact on the counties.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, if I could add, this has been on the agenda for a while, and they never, none of the counties ever contacted us. So.
All right.
I know, isn't there somebody from one of the county mental health
Well, Bobby
programs?
Green's here, and I'm going to put Bobby on the spot here as to, weighing in for the counties at this point. I guess what I wanted to know, based on what you're telling us, that we may be able to make up time on one of the issues that's going to come in at the end. We did have the handout that came in from DLC, and how much time would you like to make a presentation? Why don't you come on up? That way we can get it on the record. And I'm assuming that if Bob did come back up, he's going to give us the same cautions that he did already as the constitutionality and the length of time and making certain, because I know we did have that one issue regarding extending out someone's being able to be reviewed by the parole probation security board, and basically had to have that safety net that allowed someone to go through a petition process to be able to go in earlier than waiting the full length of time. And that's what I would assume we'd have to do here if we were going to go there. Go ahead.
Morning, Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Bill Hafel, and I'm the Health Services Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And this is Jenna Russell, and she is the Administrator for the Mental Health Program Behavioral Health Services with the Department of Corrections. House Bill 3342, as you've heard, would change the way certain mentally ill offenders would be housed and treated. If this bill were to become law, men and women who have been found guilty except for insanity of aggravated murder or Measure 11 crimes would be sentenced to the custody of DOC. These offenders will be transferred to the Oregon State Hospital or a secure intensive community inpatient facility prior to coming to DOC. After 90 days, the Psychiatric Security Review Board would determine whether the person is no longer affected by a mental defect or disease, or if so affected, no longer requires continued commitment to a state hospital or secure intensive community inpatient facility, and that's a quote out of the bill. If the PSRB finds the person is no longer affected, that person would be transferred to the Department of Corrections. So challenges for the Department of Corrections.
And what I'm going to ask you to do, Bill, is to just kind of summarize instead of reading. We can read for it.
primarily two main issues for us. The first is we're a prison system that provides mental health treatment. We are not a mental health treatment facility. And we don't have the resources or facilities to take on this additional group. We already struggle to fill positions and to handle the vast numbers of people with a mental illness diagnosis in corrections now. I can't tell you how many of these folks would end up coming. I mean, it's until we're actually in place. But we do know there's going to be an impact. And if they're mentally ill enough to be considered insane and not be responsible, that's a whole different level for us. That would be what our mental health infirmaries do now. We have 72 beds statewide, and that's for both men and women. So our ability to be able to take them in, prison by its nature is not really a stable environment for the mentally ill. I sat on the committee when they first began looking at what to do about the state hospital as Max Williams' representative. One of the things that the consultants talked about is the single biggest thing that you can do to reduce anxiety in the mentally ill is space. Well, that's one of the things that we don't have. We basically stack people together pretty closely. We're just concerned about our ability to provide the level of treatment that these folks would need and keep both our staff and inmates safe.
All right. Thank you for putting your comments on the record. Were there any questions for either? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to go ahead and shift over to our next topic, and Chair Barker will oversee this one.
The next item on the agenda is House Bill 2682. Should Oregon return to the option of having private CRDs posting a bond for those charged with a crime? Bill, do you have any introductory remarks on that?
Chair Barker, I actually have it.
Oh, Tom O'Brien was the staff person.
Thank you. If you look in your materials under the blue tab, I wrote just a small memo on the bail bonds issue. House Bill 2682 requires our committee to take testimony on this issue. It also lists several considerations that we need to take testimony on and lists groups that need to be part of the work group. We have Paul Romaine and Jim Gardner and their guests here today to talk about the issue, and the thought is we would spin it off into a work group after what we hear today.
Okay, great. Mr. Romaine? Gardner? Okay. Hey, Luke. Go ahead and come on up. If you would introduce yourself by your name for the record, and then just please proceed in any order you wish.
Good morning, Chair Barker, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Bartlett. I am the Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition, which is a consortium of bail insurance companies. I've been working in this field for about 15 years since I retired from the Department of Justice Criminal Division, where I served on a cross assignment to Interpol Washington as Special Assistant to the Director of the FBI for Interpol and International Law Enforcement Matters. I do have a history. I'm from the other Washington, more pleasant Washington State, and I did live in your state for 4 years. I was over at the Jesuit Novitiate at Sheridan, Oregon, looking down on the Yamhill Valley for 4 years from 1960 to 1964. Actually, the first time I was in this building was on a field trip in 1963 when we got a chance to come in and be introduced to the floor of the house from the gallery, and we also had a chance to meet the governor, then Mark Hatfield. But my purpose here today is to introduce my colleague, Charles Noble. Charles is my consultant on matters dealing with pretrial services. He has a long background, which I'll let him elaborate on. I've been in the field for a long time. I also was on a member of the ABA Pretrial Standards Committee and served in that capacity. And if there's anybody, there may be people in the country that know more about this topic than Charles, but I don't know about them. Thank you. Charles?
Chair Barker. Chair Brzezinski. I'm the guy he's talking about. Yeah. I was the director of the second or third largest pretrial service program in the nation for about 15 years. I have been recognized as an expert witness in at least four federal jail litigation matters regarding jail and prison overcrowding. I got a number of national awards. Yeah, that part is true. I did work for four governors, never here in Oregon, but working in Rhode Island on the governor's task force, well, that was a real pleasure. I have spent more time in jails, in prisons. I've spent my entire life there, and I was on the right side of the bars. And I retired when I was 50. I'm 60 years old now. I retired. I'd had enough, but I'm still semi-active, actually very active within the field. I like to chuckle at about some of the antics that I see people do. My real claim to fame, however, is not something that Mr. Bartlett, who is a good friend of mine, would tell you about. You see, I got involved. I was sued because people thought I was lying, thought I was embellishing, thought I was exaggerating that I couldn't be as good as I was. That was a 3-year federal lawsuit. We went to trial. I'm here to tell you I was wrong on my stats. I didn't pay attention in college and graduate school when it came to finite math. I was off 0.02%. I apologize. That case went away. And I retired, and I enjoy my retirement now. I'm very pleased to be here to speak with you today. I do this quite naturally. I'm not trying to impress anybody, because the research really hasn't changed that much since when I was active within the field. Let me tell you simply that there are two different forms of bail, many different types, but two different forms of bail. One is financial and one is non-financial. Surety bonds, which are not presently allowed within the state of Oregon, and I've been here several times working with the pretrial programs within this state. One time you had about 12, 15. I think that was in the mid-80s when I was here. Now I think you have about 3. But surety bail bonds, from a nationwide perspective, are the most dominant form of pretrial release in the country. And they're used in an active practice in 46 states. And they are used successfully. And I wanted you to know that. I don't know the history involved in this topic. I don't need to know. But you need to know that 46 states use them. And it works. In addition, while I'm going to go in sequential order with respect to the bill, and I'm going to do it very quickly, you need to know that in terms of failure to appear, those instances where a body, not a case, not a charge, but a body fails to appear in court for the disposition of that case, the defendants released on surety bail appear in court more often and accept the disposition of that case than do any other type or forms of bail in the country. And it's been that way since God was a boy. It really has. And I want to tell you that. In addition to that, when it comes to public safety, defendants who are released on surety bail, if they don't appear in court, they don't remain at large very often. Now, please forget about this guy, Mr. Dog Bounty Hunter. Forget about him. That man would not be allowed to practice within this state what he does. Bail agents, however, collect the same type of information, and they verify it in much the same fashion as do pretrial severance programs. They can't stay in business if they don't. And they perform supervision services, which are very similar on a scale of what pretrial service programs do. But their clients do not remain at large as long as defendants released on any form of bail. They don't. And you need to understand it, and I'm trying to do this simply. When it comes to House Bill 2682, and I'm only going to deal very briefly with each of the subsections, and I hope I'm speaking in language that allows you to understand what I'm saying. You have costs, the cost of the existing system. I don't know what the cost is of the existing system of pretrial service programs or pretrial release within the state. Quite frankly, nobody does. The only accurate reference I have is a 2006 Multnomah County grand jury. That referenced the local pretrial program there, which performs supervision services at about $2.6 million. that's really a very good price to pay for what that program does. You can have what they have in Washington, D.C. That'll cost you $55 million. You can have what they have in Houston, Texas. That costs a little over $8 million. Wasn't that much when I left, but that's what it is now. But the operation of a surety bail system within the state will not cost you anything. Now, I know that's difficult to believe upon face value, but the simple truth is that there are no direct costs to the state or the county. There aren't. And any indirect costs that may incur are offset by the licensings and application fees that the insurance company have to go through. In this state, you have a Department of Business and Consumer Affairs. They have a whole separate division just related to insurance. Those guys will take care of this. And I feel comfortable with that concept, and I hope you feel comfortable about it as well. Then we hit the big puppy, the failure to appear rates. There are many different ways to calculate that rate, but only one is really worth doing, and that's what's called the defendant-based rate. That's what the Department of Justice does. They take a defendant, and then they see if that defendant, not all that defendant's cases, not all that defendant's appearances, if that defendant appears when he's supposed to appear and accepts the consequences handed down by the court. It's called a defendant-based rate. The best statistical reports that are compiled in this country are based on the Bureau of Justice Statistics efforts. It's the one thing I've ever seen the government do, and I work for them, and they did it really well. It was a large, large sample of defendants, more than enough. In that rate, surety bail defendants, those defendants who got out, appeared in court more often and stayed at large, meaning they were fugitives from justice, less often than any other form of bail. That's what it was. I can tell you much more difficultly, more explicitly, but that's what it says, and those are not my words. That's what the Department of Justice wrote. And I want you to understand it, and if you have questions, please ask them. I'll be happy to answer them if I can. The impact of public safety you're also looking at when it comes to House Bill 2682. I've kind of sort of covered this. Defendants released on surety bail, if they fail to appear in court, are rearrested much more quickly and much more often for that non-appearance in court than any other form of bail. The public safety is not endangered in that respect by the use of surety bonds. They're not. There's a danger in other forms of release. But surety bonds do not impact public safety, regardless of what you may have read in the newspaper or seen on television. It just doesn't happen that way. The probable impact on your jail populations, I think that's subsection D. Subsection D is pretty unique, and you're in a really good position. I'm impressed. Oregon is following a national trend, and that, as a state, they are. And that trend is mirrored in Multnomah County. Lane County is not mirroring that trend. It's a separate entity. But in general, your jail populations are down. You haven't had to do emergency releases in about 3-4 years now. But your jails are full. But the population is decreasing. That's kind of a good thing. And the trend is expected to continue. But in addition to that population, the decline in the overall population, the number of people being booked into the jail, that's the number of people being arrested and coming in. No, that's decreasing as well. Actually, nobody really knows why, but it's a trend. You got your own separate problems here in Oregon. I mean, your crime index, crime rate's about 2% higher than average. Your property crimes are about 7% higher than average, and you've had to do massive federally mandated emergency releases to keep within the population caps. I've been through about half a dozen of those. They are not fun, and they are not useful, and it's not a good thing to do to the public. And your sheriffs, your district attorneys, your judges, they realize that. But the impact of surety bonds, it doesn't make that worse. It doesn't. In fact, it makes it better. Because surety bonds, well, they will get a certain percentage of defendants out of jail, much more so than you might imagine. That's not the real benefit. The real benefit is that they get them out of jail so much more quickly. I mean, you already have the processes in place. You need do nothing. Within the state, if you're arrested and charged with a criminal offense, there's a bail schedule that is attached to your case and to you personally as soon as the charges are filed against you. You don't have to change that. Nobody else has. And it works just fine. The sheriff's office in each and every one of your 36 counties has somebody or a group of somebodies on what's commonly known as a bonding desk 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's the nature of the beast. That's how it's done. And either the clerk or the sheriff, predominantly the sheriff, will accept an order of the court, which is like release on recognizance, or they will accept a property bond or a 10% deposit bond, which is a completely different animal, but they're financial bonds. They accept those, and you get out of jail. But the average period of time, as any of your sheriffs will tell you, particularly at Multnomah County, that if a defendant is arrested and goes to jail, here's the kicker. If they're arrested and go to jail, they will spend between 16 and 19 days in jail if they don't initially make a bond on OR, which is own recognizance. That's a long period of time. And at the end of that time, they're either going to plead out, which not a whole lot of them do, or they just don't get out, but the average is about 16 to 19 days. Surety bail will lower that population much more quickly than any other form of bail. They will. And they will do it without, I want to say, unnecessarily endangering the community. There is a risk, but they do the best job in the country over it. Now then, that's basically my presentation to you. I've enjoyed speaking to you. I really have. If you have any questions, I'd like to give them a shot. Please, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
Maybe I should interject now, since I'm a native Texan. I can translate anything you might need.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Chair Przanski, if you would like me to lurch into a southern drawl, I can do that in a heartbeat.
I think you've done enough.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I have some concern, and now that the senator brought this up too, from being from the state of Texas, that last portion of he sincerely enjoyed being in front of us. Question.
That's a polite way of saying.
I'd like to ask you just kind of overall how the surety bond usually works is if I arrested and the judge says $5,000 bail, then I put up 10%. Or the bondsman does. What does that cost me?
All right. Mr. Chairman and Chair Barker, if you were arrested because you didn't like a guy from Texas and you slugged him on the way out of this room, that's a criminal charge and shame on you. Wow. Your bond amount in the state would be about $2,000 to $5,000. A bail bondsman could get you out of jail for about 10% of that. It's non-refundable, but it's $500. However, if you think that that process is wrong, and that would occur within about 12 hours from the time of your arrest, if you think that is wrong, then that is your right. You wait in jail for about 72 hours based on what you do for a living and how long you lived here, regardless of where you were born. You'd probably get out of jail in about 72 hours. But what it costs is about 10% of the face amount of the bond. Now, the bondsman does not make that 10%. I mean, I guess they do initially, but they have to pay. The reason they don't cost you anything is that they have to pay their own operational cost. You don't pay them for this privilege. They pay their own operational cost, and we're talking about insurance bondsmen. The type of bondsman you may have heard stories about that ceased to exist when I was a boy. I certainly knew some of them, and I'm certainly pleased to tell you that they're not in business anymore. Now the insurance business, surety bail is an insurance business, is highly regulated. It is, and I'm just tickled pink. Because they watch those guys, they watch those little rascals closely. And they do a real good job of it. So I hope that answers your question. It's going to cost you about 10%, but you don't necessarily have to pay that. Your relatives, your friends, they'll be fighting off over each other. And if you're not worth putting up 10% of that bond, they're not going to make it. And that should tell you something. If you're not worth that 10% of the bond, then maybe sort of you ought to kind of stay in jail for the public safety a little bit longer.
And should I not show up, then they're responsible for the $5,000.
Yeah, it's just as simple as that. I say, yeah. Yes, sir. It's just as simple as that. But more than that, they're also responsible and actively involved with good information. Just let me comment on that, of getting the body back into custody. When a defendant speaks to a pretrial service employee or to a bail bondsman, it's what's called defendant data. I mean, we hear what you tell us, but it's worthless. It is not good information until it's verified, and that's what I did real, real good. I turned defendant data into usable data. I didn't pioneer that program. I cheated. I went and watched bail bondsmen do it, and I learned from them. I really did. I have a lot of friends who are bail bondsmen. They hated the fact what I did because I did it so well. But no, a bail bondsman will turn that defendant data into usable data, which that bondsman will then share. They'll track him down, but he'll pay the money and still help track you down. Yes, it happens just that way.
Okay, and just one other comment I'd make as far as savings to the counties and so on. I'm a retired police officer, and there's many times I showed up in court, the defendant didn't, and I got 6 hours pay for my 5 minutes.
I bet you enjoyed that. I'm sorry.
I helped negotiate those contracts.
I bet you. It is a pain, but I'll bet you enjoyed the experience.
Well, I didn't enjoy it when I worked night shift and had to come in for that, and that's why the pay is set that way. But it's very expensive for the counties to reset. And
the national average, and I think you're referring to release on recognizance, depending upon where you were, the national average is a little higher than 1 out of 4 that fail to appear. You know where they were at the point in time you arrested them, at least if you had a driver's license, you know where you thought they were.
Yeah.
Chances are they didn't live there longer than about 3 hours after they got out. And finding these little puppies after they've run amok and skedaddle someplace, there's an art to that. But you need to have good information to go from. You may have heard that bail bondsmen profit financially even if the defendant doesn't show up in court. That's nonsense. They don't stay in business if you don't show up in court. But it's 1 out of 4, and just to kind of let me do my stuff a little bit, bail bondsman, or the surety bail industry, is about 200% better in getting people to show up for court, and then if they don't, having them arrested within a very narrow time frame. Generally, it's 180 days. That's the national average. And, sir, Representative Olson, I really am enjoying this. I'm not under any pressure. I'm really having the time of my life. I tried to get these guys in to buy me a pizza last night, but they're cheap. No.
Yeah, so I just want to follow up, Mr. Noble, on the example. So if a person came in and they had that $5,000 bond that was posted, they would be paying a bail bondsman or surety $500. That's non-refundable. So that's the transaction between them. The surety that's actually posting the bond is on the hook potentially for the full $5,000 if the person doesn't show up. Can you walk us through as to how you've seen either in Harris County, in Harris County, I guess it was through the pre-release, but other parts?
No, it was on a surety bond.
Okay.
We have both.
The enforcement action taken by the courts as to how rigid they were to actually, foreclose on that bond and actually make them pay?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair. In making these statements, it's really a very simple process, and it's pretty much exactly as he outlined it, but I'll take it step by step, take about 30 seconds. If a defendant released on a surety bond, failed to appear in court at the point in time he was supposed to be there, the court can either excuse the absence for good reason or they can forfeit the bond. If the bond is forfeited at that point in time, the bail agent, the registered agent of insurance company, is on the hook. But his parent company, that's the one who's going to pay. It may come out of the agent's operational capital, but the registered agent's on the hook for the money. In the court, typically, in about 20 states that I've been to, including Texas, they typically want the body back. And so all of the efforts for about 180 days, even though the bondsman is fully liable, I mean, they don't have a defense unless the guy is dead at the bottom of the river, then that's a pretty good excuse why the court would excuse the absence and the bond would not be forfeit. But if the defendant doesn't appear, the bond is forfeit, and after 180 days, somebody better come up with a good check. The cashier's check is normally how it's done. It's paid. And if it's not paid within that time frame, that company and that agent are not doing business in that state or in that county any longer.
What type of authority does the surety bondholder have to arrest an individual who is on the
All right. The bail bondsman typically doesn't perform what's called a civil arrest, meaning they go out and pick up. However, if a court in most states, not in all states, and it wouldn't be so in this state, if the court has issued an arrest warrant, pretty much today the bondsman just finds him and works with a certified peace officer, a group of detectives, or even a patrolman and said, this is where the guy is, I found him. And even when a so-called bounty hunter who does it for a living, there are really not many of those, and they love the limelight, but there are not very many of them, and bonds, surety bond companies really don't use them very often. It's up to the agent to work with the local law enforcement, and despite what you may have heard, a law enforcement officer is not going to walk away from a felon with an open warrant. They're not going to do that. If he knows that felon's in there, he'll stop what he's doing long enough to go in there and get him. And even if a bail agent was trying to serve a warrant, a good warrant, as terms of a citizen, no, he's going to have a police officer there. That's what they do.
Okay. Thank you.
And just one other thing. When I first started, we did have, as in police work there, that we did have bail bondsmen in Oregon, and I've seen cases where the bail bondsman did locate the person, get them, I assume fairly voluntary, but got them back into court, and then the judge who had pulled the bond would restore it to the bondsman for bringing the guy back in, or at least part of it. So that worked, seemed to work out pretty complimentary to the system. Further questions? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Noble, why do we think that this is a practice better done, more successfully done by private company than by public entities? And I understand it would not be necessarily instead of, it'd be both, but still it is sort of instead of for some of them. Why do we think that there's a greater success rate among, or why would, if in fact there is, why do you think it's better to be done, sort of privatized, than done by public entity?
Chair Barker, Chair Brzezinski, Representative Smith, thank you. First of all, it's a fact. You were right. It is a fact. But jurisdictions, regardless of what anybody's going to tell you, you need an option for how a defendant gets out of jail. The defendant needs the option. The court and the legislature just approves the option for the defendant to use. And we really know why defendants released on surety bail perform better. And everybody thinks, well, that's because they can buy their way out of court. No, it's really not. The type of defendants, it really is a good question, that are selected by bail insurance agents, they're the cream of the crop. The fact that they can afford the fee is a fact, but that also shows that they have a job, that they're successful, that they have ties to this community. They are typically responsible people. or they, their relatives are very responsible people. If their family is involved, it shows that they have what we assume to be, at the initial moment, strong family ties. They are a much better candidate to appear in court than is somebody. I mean, you got a heavy homeless population here, is a way of answering your question. And last night I took a walk around my hotel and I was accosted about five times from these young people. They were carrying little signs saying, being homeless sucks. And they'd get off their cell phone just long enough to ask me for a dollar. Yeah, I don't know why that is, but it occurs. That's not the type of person that a bail bondsman's going to immediately rush out and say, let me get you out of jail. And there ought to be a warning sign to answer your question that goes off in your mind. The person doesn't have any ties here. Quite frankly, you're going to have the devil of the time finding them if once they do abscond. But assure you, bondsman takes all of this into consideration. My side of the equation, pretrial service agencies, we don't think they do, but I know differently. And I've told them differently, and I will continue to tell them differently. A bail bondsman doesn't want, he will ensure to the best of his professional and human ability that that defendant is in court, even if he has to take him over there his own self. Does that answer your question, sir?
I think so. Sure. So I think what you've explained to me, and it's really helpful, is that private bail bondsmen have a better rate because they're better at selecting a population that is more likely to appear.
You know, people are trying to study, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the government's trying to study that right this very moment. And the same authors of the big Bureau of Justice study, which is called the State Processing Court Statistics, Reporting Statistics, the same authors of that report are doing their own independent research. They admit that surety bond defendants, everybody does, appear more often and stay at large less often. But they're trying to find out why. They already know. They're just trying to find a way to prove it. And that's because a bondsman has more resources as a private businessman. Yes, they are profit motivated. I'm not going to hide that. But they have more resources and they get to select who they get out. They do. Let me compare that with a public system of bail, which is what I did for a living. And I was extremely good at my job. I was better than pretty much everybody else, but it was like being the mayor of a small city. As a public entity, you might think we have a lot of resources. No, we're too busy interviewing the people that comes in. I did the vote against the advice of everybody on my side of the table. Selected personnel to a fugitive apprehension unit, but that's very rare. Pretrial service programs in the government really doesn't have a lot of resources unless you get an energetic detective or a very inquisitive police officer. I hope that answers your question.
It's helpful. Thank you very much.
Any further comments?
I just have one further comment talking about the revenue stream. Bail insurance companies also pay premium tax, so that would be a revenue stream coming in. We're talking about the offsetting of whatever expenses that the state would have in instituting this. It would be more than offset by premium taxes.
Mr. Chairperson, if I might, very briefly, I left one thing out. Shame on me. There is a fiscal impact to surety bail. Now, they're not real wild about me telling you about this, but it's true. As I understand the law, as it exists or will exist, if there is a forfeiture, the insurance companies will pay it, and they will pay the full amount of the bond. Don't expect them to smile when they do it, but it's the cost of doing business for them, and they're going to do it. There's no way to calculate exactly how much money. I can give you a for instance, and I will very quickly. Have 100 defendants. Let's do it that way. 100 defendants. Average bond amount is, say, $5,000. When that case goes to forfeiture, those defendants, somebody help me with the finite math, is that $2 million those 500 defendants represent? Something like that, I think. That's what the jurisdiction could estimate that they would collect, and that's a lot of money for victims' witness programs, crime victims. It's a lot of money to help out the single parents that don't get their child support. I mean, that's basically what that money is used for. And I think you probably should ought to consider it. I'm finished for today, and I have enjoyed being in front of you. I really have.
Thank you very much, and we expect to have further discussions. Mr. Gardner and Mr. Romaine are being a work group, and we'll see if we can't have something ready for the 2011 session. I'm going to work with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 603, a bill allowing convicted felons to obtain the right to carry a firearm 15 years after conviction in limited circumstances. And Honor, who is that?
Actually, Bill Taylor was doing this one, but I believe we have someone from the State Department of Justice to talk about the technical corrections of 603.
Okay. Somebody here testify on Senate Bill 603?
There, dude. I just saw Bill go out in the hall and talk to everyone.
Okay, thank you. Bill?
Chairman of the committee, I understand we're on Senate Bill 603. I was just out in the hallway talking with Sean Riddell from the District Attorney, Department of Justice, David Ames Brief from Linn County District Attorney's Office, and Kevin Sterrett. I think they're still talking out in the hallway. The issue here is there was evidently when the bill came, I did not staff the bill on the Senate side, but when it came over to the Senate, another bill was added to it. And I don't think it was the committee's intent to do this, but the end result, and this was not a drafting error, this in addition, was that a person, normally a person convicted of a felony cannot apply to carry a firearm, okay? David Ames, we just walked in. I hope everyone else is coming in, too.
If the committee wants, I'll go ahead and get the...
Oh, yeah.
Sure. And what happened is the end result, someone who walks out of prison right now with five felony convictions can walk to court and petition to possess and carry a firearm. And I don't think that was what was really intended. This has been pointed out to us, and I believe they're looking for a technical correction to the issue in the February session. So, okay. So you may want to call all the parties up together. We just started the conversation as to what happened, what didn't happen, and where they'd like to see it go.
If the parties want to come on up. And then one other item in there that we want to just clarify, in the original bill had a provision for somebody on a motorcycle or an ATV. And presently, if somebody was to call me and say, I'm from Idaho and I'm coming into Oregon on my motorcycle, where do I put my firearm?
Okay.
The original bill had a provision that they could have it in a secure and locked box attached to the vehicle. And so I'm interested in having that back into. Please go ahead. And you come on up, too, if you're... Oh, okay. Whoever else? Okay.
Dave wants to come up, but he's not being allowed to come up.
If the committee required me to, I will. Otherwise, I'll...
Okay, that's fine.
Good morning. My name is Sean Riddell. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the Chief Counsel for the Criminal Justice Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I've met several of you before at the last legislative session, and Senator, we've actually spoke on the phone at last legislative session. Nice to meet you in person. I'd like to talk about Senate Bill 603 and our proposed fix to that. Right now, as the law is passed now, which will go into effect in January, what will happen is anyone, regardless of the number of convictions, the felony convictions they have, and the time period from the conviction, under the current writing, is allowed to go in and apply for relief from the restrictions of a felon possession of a firearm, and then the misdemeanor unlawful possession of a firearm. Our fix that we have presented here, what this would do here is only affect unlawful possession of a firearm insofar as the misdemeanor. So if you have one felony conviction, after the 15-year waiting period that is in felon possession of a firearm, you may then apply for relief from the misdemeanor. After 15 years, the felon possession of a firearm statute would no longer apply to you, and then you would have, once again, the right and privilege of owning a firearm, once again. And that's the limited fix that we have here. Any questions?
Clarify that again. So right now, the way we wrote it and it came out is not good because it does. It's been 15 years since I've been in prison today, I can't buy a gun because I'd fall under the misdemeanor.
There are two statutes at play here with the ownership of a firearm as it applies to a felon. There is the felon possession of a firearm, and then there's the misdemeanor unlawful possession of a firearm. As the law stands now, if you are convicted of a felony, you have a lifetime ban under the misdemeanor of possessing a firearm, and you have a 15-year ban if you have one felony conviction under the felon in possession of a firearm, with some exceptions of homicide, which carry with it a lifetime ban. The change made in the last legislative session affords someone not only relief under the misdemeanor, but immediate relief under the felon in possession of a firearm. Our fix here is recognizing that the lifetime ban under the misdemeanor recognizing the lifetime ban of the misdemeanor, which is what the bill was originally set to fix, should still be fixed and allow person relief from the misdemeanor and lifetime ban for one felony conviction, but still keeps in place the 15-year waiting period for that conviction and the lifetime ban for multiple felony convictions under the felon in possession of a firearm. Did I answer your question, Chair Barker?
Yes, you did.
Chair Barker, is the 15 years waiting period, does that begin at the time of the conviction or the time of release from prison?
Release from prison.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Chair Barker.
Any further questions? Representative Tomei.
Well, I'm the new kid on the block here, so I'm totally confused. So the Senate Bill 603 that we have is the old bill, the one that was passed last
That's correct.
The regular session. So the bill that this gentleman is referring to, we don't have in front of us anywhere, right?
You're talking about the fix to
the fix
to 603, based on how it's been interpreted by DOJ, as what the impact it actually has, which was considered unintended most members when we were putting 603 together.
I've got that. But we don't have that in front of us.
That's correct. Right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Department of Justice and Legislative Counsel's Office have been talking about a draft, but as you know, we can't get a draft of anything for several months because they're still in the process of editing from the 2009 session, and basically you can't do a draft until you've done the editing because that's the template that you work off of. Otherwise, you're working off the 2007 template, and that would cause lots of problems. So there's been communications with the Department of Justice and Josh Nasby about how we fix this technical problem.
And will we be ready to fix it in February?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. If the committee chooses to go.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And
motorcycle piece as well.
Yeah. Okay. And so I guess the other part is Chair Barker has brought up regarding what I think the intent that both chambers had regarding making sure all vehicles, including motorcycle type of vehicles, that we will want to include that addition into it since it was somehow dropped. So we'd like DOJ to be involved in that to make certain we cover everything as to the language doesn't have other unintended consequences.
anything else.
So will this come forward as a committee bill?
Yes, I think it's right now set up as possible Senate committee bill, if I'm not mistaken.
Could be, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, yes.
Okay, nothing further. Thank you very much.
Okay. In closing, if I may, this is my ninth week as Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. I look forward to working with all of you in the future and look forward to the upcoming legislative session. And I'd like to take this opportunity to give you all an open invitation to come visit us over on 610 Hawthorne and see what we do and meet the people with the Criminal Justice Division. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Members of the committee, we did find out in the hallway that Sean and Kevin Starrett, the families both originate from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn. So.
Excellent.
Uh-oh. Oh, man. We're in trouble.
All the secrets will be told.
Not everyone could be from Boston.
Thank God. Where's Kevin?
He's back
there. Oh, there he is. Kevin, you want to come up and just put on the record real quick as to what we've kind of glossed over?
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. With all due respect to the previous speaker, I think they completely misinterpreted Senator Przanski. When you and I discussed this bill, what they're complaining about was the very thing we were trying to fix. The fact is that under current law, a person with a felony conviction can currently apply to the courts, petition the courts to have their rights restored, to buy a firearm, but they may not own it. And 603 corrected that by saying that a person who successfully petitioned the courts would have his rights restored, not simply to purchase it, but to own it. The current law simply makes no sense. It's ridiculous to say I can buy something, but I can't own it. And 603 addressed that. It doesn't automatically restore anybody's rights. They still have to convince the court, irrespective of how many convictions they've had, they still have to convince the court they should be allowed to have their firearms rights restored. But this is not an unintended effect of the bill. This is not a technical error. If anything, the one technical error that still exists in the bill, besides the motorcycle language, is that the 15-year issue wasn't correctly addressed. Currently, after a person has been released from custody, prison, probation, or parole for a period of 15 years, if that person has only one felony conviction, and it was not a homicide or a weapons charge, that person has his rights restored automatically, but only to no longer be charged with felon in possession. He can still be charged with unlawful misdemeanor possession. I had hoped to have that fixed in 603, but it doesn't really address that. All 603 does in that respect is say, if your rights are restored, they're restored so you can neither be charged with misdemeanor or felon in possession. So I don't believe that 603 has a technical error, and I think 603, in fact, in its form, is addressing the very mistake that allows a person to buy something but not own it. And if there's an understanding on the part of the committee that this somehow automatically restores a felon's rights, that's not the case at all.
Mr. Taylor,
as a committee, with my discussions with the Department of Justice was that you have the possibility of someone coming out of prison today with five or six felonies who could then apply to have their rights restored, or their right, by going to, as the law is an unusual law, to county court. And it's obvious that we probably need to sit down and with a work group and chat about some of these details, but that was what was raised with me, and I wasn't there at the committee hearing, but that would seem unusual to even allow someone at that point to apply for it. Now, it doesn't mean the judge is going to give it to that person, but the way the statute's written, your first bite of the apple is at county court, and then circuit court if you want to go that route. So it's an unusual statute in that regard.
Mr. Smith, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And with that, so let's say I had convictions in various jurisdictions. Let's imagine I have a federal conviction. Let's imagine I have a state conviction, et cetera. Would I need to petition the court of origin, or could I just petition the court that, you know, in fact, like, for instance, the judge that might have, in fact, heard testimony and been involved in the trial, or could I just go to the, you know, my local judge who, you know, might not have as much background about the facts of the case, and that person could wipe clean, well, not wipe clean, but make irrelevant with regard to my ability to own and possess and purchase a firearm, wipe that clean.
I'm not sure. Mr. Taylor, do you know?
Don't have to go to point of origin, court of origin.
Okay. Okay. Well, we'll get these clarified, and get the bill we want, which takes care of those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have a question of you or counsel. What is the other bill that was combined with 603? Please, does anybody know?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
What was the other bill that was combined with 603? We merged two, but I don't remember.
Chairman of the committee, there was another bill, and I believe it had something to do with conflict amendments. I have it in my file upstairs, and I'm sorry, I don't have it here.
I just want to look at my notes. Thank you.
Mr. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize that I'm underinformed on the statute. Would there be any exceptions to the felonies? Would there be some, let's say it was violent firearm crimes, that would there still be just this blanket ability to apply for and potentially receive the ability to purchase and own a firearm, or would it only be certain types of felonies?
Other than murder. After 15 years, a person could apply, but then the court would review that and decide. And that's 15 years, you know, after they're out and off of everything, so that's pretty late in life for most.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, Bill, regarding our agendas that are for both committees, have we concluded pretty much everything we have at this point?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Allen, you still have to, we do have a discussion about potential bills for concession. I don't see Renee Bryant here. She's out here. She represents the state police. They are looking for legislation in February that would allow them regulatory authority as it relates to around the Walsh Act, and I think it would be best that she came up. And
yeah, please.
Good morning, Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Renee Bryan. I represent the Oregon State Police. We brought six bills forward during the last legislative session related to the sex offender registration program that the Oregon State Police administers. And following the session, we looked at adopting some rules to enact those measures. And we found in conversations with our Assistant Attorney General that we have no general rulemaking authority for the department, and we have no specific rulemaking authority for the program. So we were looking in the February session for a bill that would provide the program with specific rulemaking authority related to the sex offender registration program. The kinds of things that we would like to further define for the process to make it uniform and consistent throughout the state would be what it means to move into the state of Oregon, or what a residence is. Does it have to be a permanent residence, a temporary residence? Under which conditions would those terms apply to individuals in the SOR program? So that's what we were seeking, and that's about it.
Is there any questions?
All right, staff will continue to work with you, and we'll put together at least giving authorization to go to LC to start getting that done. It seems to me to be pretty reasonable as to making certain that the agency that is supposed to be doing the regulations has the ability to actually bring forward the rulemaking that's necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Taylor.
Anything for
Chairman, as a committee, the rules are slightly different between the House and the Senate. For the House side, by October 5th, we have to send a memo to the Speaker requesting an LC draft. The Senate has two bills and has until November, but even their deadline is before our next meeting. Is this an expression of one of the committee's side to forward this bill into February so that we would have...
Sure.
The House side will take that. We'll speak with, I'll be speaking with the Speaker this afternoon, and I'll bring that up to him.
Okay.
That time.
Thank you.
The House will do it. Okay, thank you.
All right, so the proposals, anything else you want to go over for other proposed legislation?
Does anybody have any proposed legislation they want to talk about?
Yeah, at the committee.
Well, we have one committee bill, and we'll probably run the state police one out, get that straightened out for them.
All right. So, Mr. Taylor, I think at this point, Bill, our next agenda item is the one that's been reserved for the Senate. Unless there's something else that we need to go over, then at this point, I guess, before we go into the campus safety, Jeff, do you want to go ahead and close the chairs?
Is there any further business for the House side? Hearing none, the House Interim Judiciary Committee is adjourned.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Do you want any of us to...
Okay.
What the Senate intention is to have some, hear some evidence today, some testimony today, and then set up a work group
if you'd like.
We're going to have a work group, and for members of the House Judiciary, you're more than welcome to sit in if you'd like to, or just monitor it in your office or with staff, however you'd like to participate. Love to have you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. So this is going to bring us into our last, I believe, of the items that we have for the Senate side. This is an overview regarding campus safety. And Neil Bryant, I'm going to ask to come up. And Neil, if you want to bring any people with you immediately, or we'll work it through that process.
Do you guys...
My name is Neil Bryant. I'm an attorney in Bend, Oregon, where I practiced law for 36 years. And from 1993 to 2001, I served in the Oregon State Senate, and I served on judiciary for those 8 years, and 6 of the years I had the privilege of chairing it. Today, I'm here before you on behalf of the Oregon University System, the Chancellor, and its 7 campuses. Our request is that the Senate Judiciary Committee form a work group to study and make recommendations concerning campus safety, with special emphasis on the presence of concealed handguns on campuses. It's a basic question of whether or not educational institutions, including K through 12, community colleges, and state universities, have the authority to regulate possession of weapons on their campuses. In August of 2009, the Oregon Firearms Education Foundation filed a petition with the Court of Appeals against the State Board of Higher Education and the university system, challenging its authority of the board to promulgate administrative rules that impose impositions on the sanctions for people who engage in the possession of firearms on campuses. The prohibition includes individuals who possess concealed handgun licenses, and that the basis of the challenge is ORS 166.170(1), which basically states that it's vested solely in the state legislative assembly as to where and how and when concealed handguns can be conditioned. They contend that the legislative assembly address these issues, and it prohibits possession of firearms in public buildings, but then there's an exception later on that says the prohibition does not apply for those people who have concealed handgun licenses. This form of an appeal can be brought without going through circuit court under ORS 183 because it allows you to challenge the statutory authority for a rule, and this challenge is based upon the statute that I just cited and also the allegation that it violates the Constitution. The attorney representing the petitioners is Vance Day. The system will rely on the Attorney General to defend this, but it's anticipated that the briefing for the petitioner will be in November of 2009. The Department of Justice will probably file their response in January of 2010, and oral arguments could be set in the spring and as early as February 2010. I attach a copy of the rule that the State Board has adopted and also the statutes that are in question. The other case that is pending that creates the urgency for this work group is Jane Doe versus the Medford School District. And this is a case that involved a teacher who went through a contentious divorce and then obtained a concealed handgun license and wanted to bring that handgun to school for her own protection against her own husband, her ex-husband. The district had a rule that prohibited employees from having handguns on school property. She filed a lawsuit in Jackson County saying, based on ORS 166, the same statute I just cited, that the district rule was void. They didn't have the authority to do that. The school district moved to dismiss. The court granted that motion, and it was appealed to the Court of Appeals. In April of last year, that was argued, and we've been waiting for that decision. And the issue can be decided by the court in a very broad sense or very narrow sense, but the court could find, for instance, that employers, by implementing and enforcing their internal policies, have the right to regulate employees and not get to the any broader constitutional issues. But the case does not address whether citizens or parents can take concealed weapons onto school campuses. And again, I mention this just to show you what the urgency of why there needs to be a work group to take a look at what should be the best policy for the state of Oregon in this regard. And of course, the Medford case only addresses community colleges and this particular school district and its rule and not community colleges or universities. So in anticipation of these judicial decisions, the Oregon University system, community colleges, and school boards and administrators want clarification as to whether or not educational institutions have the authority to regulate possession of weapons on their campuses. And this includes the question on concealed handguns. It deserves, I think, a thoughtful and thorough review. It's a difficult question. You have to balance campus safety and campus safety personnel and law enforcement agencies with the right to bear arms. Today, we suggest that the work group come forward with a recommendation for the 2011 session and that it include representatives from OUS, from community colleges and K-12. They're in the room today and they want to be a part of this and also recommend this action. I've talked to the sheriff's representative and the district attorney, and the police chiefs. They are also would like to be involved. It would be good to have a special assistant attorney general. They're called SAGs, and they're located at Portland State, Oregon State, the University of Oregon, the Chancellor's Office, because they deal with these issues on a regular basis, and I think that would be helpful in their capacity as general counsel to the system. We need someone from campus security who also has the experience of being on the ground, and we'd recommend that whoever the law enforcement representatives are, that they have an institution in their jurisdiction because they also have some valuable experience. Also, you need someone who is a gun rights advocate to serve on the work group. There are other state agencies that will be impacted by this too because they have rules concerning their employees having handguns or handguns even with concealed license being in their buildings. And for your information, I attach an article, a position paper, a study by the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators concluding that concealed handgun initiatives for students don't add to the safety of campuses. There might be a tendency, well, why don't we just wait till the courts makes their decisions? My encouragement to you is to be proactive and be prepared and have some thoughtful, well-reasoned positions. Today, I didn't know what the time frame was or if there would be any questions, but I have with me the directors of campus safety from the University of Oregon, Oregon State, and Portland State, respectively. That's Doug Tripp, Jack Rogers, and Mike Soto. If you have specific questions or wanted to ask something about a campus and their experience, they're happy to do that. And as I said, the attachments are the statutes, the position paper, and I didn't include the legal arguments in the many briefs that have been filed on this, but they definitely cover all aspects of this. And Mr. Chair, I have some specific issues that it would be most helpful if the work group were willing to address those. And with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
So let me ask the committee first questions for Mr. Bryant, and then, as he said, there are some individuals that are here. That if you had any other specific questions for them, we can ask them to come up. This is basically the framework for just getting the topic before us for a work group that's going to be more extensive over the full interim. It's not the chair's intent to try to do anything between now and February. I just think that shaping and forming the issues is going to take some time, and I also think that it's important, as important as I think it is to be, as Mr. Bryant says, proactive. We also know there's a calendaring for these two cases that are pending, and we may actually get some guidance from the courts as we're working through this process before the 2011, which to me, it's one of those things that we'd want to be as inclusive if we're going to take something forward for 2011 to be considered by the legislature, that we have as much information before we do that. Senator Wissett.
Yeah, thank you. Neil, on as you know, the governor is only authorized to do what the what is statutorily allowed under the Constitution. And so my question is, what's the statutory authority? What statutory authority does the Oregon University System cite for their ability to, alleged ability to create these administrative rules? Is that the the any person who intentionally possesses a loaded or unloaded firearm in a public building, is that what they're citing? I mean, because it seems that you have to have some statutory authority to write administrative rule.
You could cite that, but then there's the other exceptions saying it doesn't apply to a person who has a concealed handgun permit. So it answers the question as far as someone who would carry a weapon on campus, but it doesn't answer the question as far as someone who has a concealed handgun permit. And probably the best legal argument for that would be in ORS 351.070, which is the general jurisdiction for colleges and operation of their campuses. And there's an argument that is also expressed in the amicus brief filed by the Department of Justice in the Medford case that says, in addition to 351, the provisions of ORS 166 do not preclude campuses from having contractual relationships with their employees, their students, their visitors, that if you're going to be on our campus contractually, you're not allowed to have guns or handguns, even if with a concealed handgun permit. And so the legislative history on this is interesting. It mostly comes from 1995 and in the House Judiciary Committee. And I was there in 1995 on the Senate side, and I don't remember, it's 14 years ago, but I don't remember specifically from the Senate side what we talked about, other than the idea was not to have a patchwork of of rules and regulations that there would be some clear definition about what you could and could not do with a concealed handgun permit. And the rule for higher ed, and I think for most campuses of K through 12 and community colleges, were well known and already in place. But it was helpful to me to look at some of the testimony, and the chair of the House committee at the time was Representative Parks from Klamath Falls. And he was asked the question by Representative Nato whether a city ordinance with respect to an individual carrying a loaded gun openly would be prohibited. And he responded, this bill does not say that the carrying of a loaded gun cannot be prevented. It says that there is an issue of people's rights that should be the same in each locality, and the state should regulate the issue. And there was a continued discussion with Representative Tiernan and others. I don't think the legislative history is really as clear as it could be on this, and so that's one reason why we want to have the clarification on it.
Before you do that, let me just fill in a little bit here. That was my first session, so I was on the House Judiciary with Del Parks, and it was more of a trying to have uniformity throughout the state. But I think more, Senator Wissett, to your question, I've had this discussion with the University of Oregon as it pertained to police officers who were attending classes at the university. And as Neil has laid out under 351, the rationale for the universities was that they had certain rights given to them to prescribe rules and making. And the question really came down to that was preceding what happened in 95. Then when 95, when the legislation went through, what impact did it have, if any, on the 351? And so there's been some, let's say, requests for different, assessments of that. And this is part of it that I think will be formulated through this work group and bringing some of the different opinions that have come forward since these questions have been raised, to see, you know, what is in play, what can be done. And as Neil Bryan and I have talked about, if you go to a university to a sporting event, on the back of the ticket, it's pretty well regulating. If you're entering here, we're going to limit your rights to do these various things. So then the question is, who's not being regulated? And that would be basically someone from the general public, who's not somehow attached to the school through some type of contractual agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead with the other.
Yes, thank you for that explanation. First of all, the precise site is 351 point what?
351.070, I believe, is the...
Thank you. And my concern is it's not, you know, it's not what's precluded by statute, it's what's allowed by statute. The question was, is there a statutory site? And I'm not familiar with the 351.070, but is there a statutory authorization for the university system to regulate the use of firearms?
I do not believe ORS 351.070 specifically references firearms. It just references you've got the right to make your own rules.
Yeah, it's a general overview for all rulemaking. And they've taken the position that because of that authority, that they have the right to do so. And the other, I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that's the.
So they're taking the position that that trumps their rule, trumps preemption law that was passed at a later time.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And so part of the reason that the Senate, I'm willing to have this work group is because I think it is something we need to flesh out. Mm-hmm. There's been some discussions, and I expect that through this work group that some of the opinions that have been generated as to who does or doesn't have what authority, all of those can be brought to the table, and then we can decide what, if anything, we're going to do and give clarity for everyone as to what can or can't be done through rulemaking as it currently exists.
Thank you.
Senator Romici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back to the Capitol, Mr. Bryant.
Thank you.
I understand that the Medford case was based on a teacher. I believe she was a high school, is a high school teacher.
I'm not sure. She was a teacher, and I'm not sure what level she was teaching.
Okay. And it's also my understanding that the question arose at the university level because it was a student, not a member of the faculty or staff who wanted to carry a concealed weapon.
Yes, you're probably referring to the Western Oregon case, which occurred last winter. And in that case, a student violated the student conduct code with a rifle and two knives, and then he also had a concealed handgun and concealed handgun permit. The student was not prosecuted criminally, but went through a student disciplinary process, not on the concealed handgun issue, but on the others. And as I understand, the sanction was he was to write an essay and was suspended for a while for violating the rule. It did not go to court, but that got a lot of publicity, and there was a public hearing in Monmouth about that.
Thank you. A follow-up, please. I understand that probably the scope of the work group is broader than that, but I just think it's important to understand that we're not just talking about faculty, we're talking about students as well. And my comment on the work group, it says in the written testimony that you submitted that there's a suggestion for a representative from gun rights advocates, and I suggested it would be important to have the balance of having someone as well from an organization like Ceasefire Oregon or someone who's a gun safety advocate as well, just to balance that.
No, by all means. Those are just our suggestions, and of course it's up to the committee how large to make the group and who to appoint.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Representative Smith, you're here. I know you're just kind of observing. Is there anything that you'd like to add? Or?
Yeah, I want to be within the bounds of propriety. I think it's a fascinating set of questions, and I'm sort of the, you know, wider school of, you know, of gun ownership. You know, I don't care if you own a gun. I just won't care if you carry a gun in town, and wondering how we want to apply that to campuses, and also wondering if the patchwork method of isn't better. I mean, is uniformity what is important, or are there different factors facing different campuses? And these are questions I don't know the answer to, but interested in what's going on in the work group. I'm not self-nominating myself, but do want to learn so that I'm, you know slightly more than necessary to be dangerous.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the rule for the Oregon University system is here's a general rule, and we don't want to have guns on campus, but there are exceptions that are allowed on a campus-by-campus basis. For instance, OIT is in a different culture in Eastern, and you know, they may allow more activities in regards to gun activities than might happen in Portland. Hunter Safety, Ducks right. Unlimited, people who have come to school and they store their hunting weapons in a facility and check them in and out because they can go hunting. So there is some flexibility for doing that, and some discretion in each campus. You know, one size doesn't fit all, and the rule that's in effect now allows that.
Thanks.
Another question. Thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bryant, have you looked at what other states do in this regard?
Yes, and in fact, not surprisingly, other states have been dealing with the same issues. And most states have adopted the public policy that guns on campuses, any campus, isn't a good idea. But there are some states that have more flexibility. For instance, Utah allows a concealed handgun permit. But apparently then they're notified who has the permit, and if they have a gun in campus, security goes and visits them, make sure it's locked in a safe place, it's where the ammo is stowed, those sorts of things. Montana just passed a law, but basically protecting concealed handgun licensees, but says not on college campuses. That's still up to the individual campuses. So other states have addressed this recently, and from the higher ed perspective, The concern is if you allow students to have concealed handguns, I think your paper will that I've attached shows you that that doesn't increase campus safety. And the risk is, and we all, I think, were in college, you know, you've got a concealed handgun, it's there legally, you've got a permit, your friends and you had a few beers, say, hey, I'd like to see your 357 Magnum or whatever, and you take it out and you start, you know, handling it and using it. Hopefully it's not loaded. Or, you know, you've broken up with your girlfriend and you're under extreme stress because of that. Or you're really unhappy with the professor in the class. I mean, just why have the availability of a weapon on campus? That's the issue for us.
It should be a lively work group.
It will.
All right. Is there any other comments? Okay, so the chair's intent is to move forward with a work group. What I'd like from committee members, if you have any suggestions of other individuals or groups that you think should be part of this, please get them to either Anna or Bill. Who's taking the lead on this?
I think Bill.
All right, to Bill. And then also for those who are here in the general public, if you'd like to also submit names or whatever, please get them to Mr. Taylor, and then we'll be moving forward. And what I would expect is that we'll try to get the that work group formulated between now and our next meeting, which is November 19th. And at that point, we can maybe get at least some feedback as to the group and whether we think it's fairly representative of the cross sections that we want. And we'll try to set up some type of schedule for ongoing meetings after that.
Thank you.
That work?
You bet.
All right. For the good of the order, what else do we need to do for today?
Yeah.
All right. And I just want to close. I want to thank all our members for being here, and also want to put on the record again, Senator Broquist would have been here, but he has military duties that took him out of the country, out of the state. I think he's in Fort Bragg. And because of that, he's not able to join us today. But with that, that concludes our work, and thank you very much. And if you notice, you have an extra hour and 5 minutes to have lunch before afternoon meetings. Adjourned.
All right.